Share your thoughts. Look for ABCRN on Facebook.
On RN, online and on your mobile, I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me. You all know, I'm sure, the feeling. A beautiful sunset has erupted at the end of a lovely day. A crescent moon hangs against the backdrop of one of those flawless skies, yet you're too busy to stop what you're doing to give it anything other than a cursory glance. The simple pleasures of life are so easily overwhelmed by all the other stuff going on, all urgently requiring your time. For many of us, modern life is lived at a frenetic pace, full of countless distractions. Believe me, I know the feeling. And it's compounded, of course, by the 24/7 digital age we live in. The smartphone, the email, Twitter, Facebook, Netflix, and by the increasing demands of work. Can you imagine Newton even noticing a falling apple if he was dashing from one meeting to the next, barking instructions on his cell phone? Would Shakespeare have finished The Tempest if he was battling the trolls on his Twitter account? These are the rhetorical questions posed by authors Martina Sheehan and Susan Pierce. How to slow down, be present, and start paying attention to what's actually going on around you is, it seems, the contemporary challenge. So how do we reconnect with our family, our friends, our partners, our workmates, and with the world around us? Martina and Susan spoke with me at the launch of their book, One Moment Please, It's Time to Pay Attention, at the Powerhouse in Brisbane.
Well, hello.
Hello.
Great to be here.
Yeah.
I thought we'd just start by talking us through the challenge or the problem that we face in this modern world, this inability to give full attention, to be in the moment, how we're constantly distracted. Some people will recognise this about themselves, I'm sure, and maybe not like it about themselves, actually. But give us an idea of this and maybe some examples to get us started. Martina.
It's a really interesting challenge. I personally can relate to it in regard to my work life. And I suppose I grew up in the era where an inbox was a paper tray. People put things in it in the beginning of the day and maybe one other time later in the day. And then I was able to look through it and put it in other people's in trays, which was great. But then you had the time to focus on the work you wanted to do between the things like phone calls at your desk and walking to a meeting and having a conversation with people. And I really think that we probably have lived through a tipping point where that is no longer the sort of pace that we live at. And we often sort of talk about it's like a tap. We used to turn a tap on. We deal with what came out, turn it off, play with that, you know, empty that bucket, and then we go back and do something else. And it's now like the tap is on all the time. And we feel like we've flooded. And by the end of the day, it's just a blur. And maybe we let it out, if you're lucky, and then we just start again. Or maybe it just feels like it's constantly, you know, we're under the surface. And that's for a whole lot of reasons. We could blame mobile technology for that. But we would suggest that's probably just highlighted the issue that we probably have.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking about that work example of how there used to be the physical in tray and you'd work your way through the physical in tray and put it into the physical out tray, and then, as you say, you'd stop doing that and you'd make phone calls. And now, though, because we now have those headsets, you know, those phone headsets, so you've got people who are reading their emails, who are on the computer at the same time as they're talking to people on the phone, so we're doing multiple things at once. Yes. And it's expected that we do multiple things at once too.
Yes. And I think probably a couple of decades ago, we were all encouraged to multitask. So that was the thing, the doing more with less, and everyone thought they had to become a great multitasker. And it's only been since we've had the science to look inside the mind that we've actually discovered that multitasking is not only really bad for your brain, but it actually is bad for your productivity.
Is that right?
Yeah, it takes 1.5 times longer to do a task when you're multitasking. It feels efficient because our brains are busy going all over the place, But when you actually measure the productivity, it takes 1.5 times longer. So I think just some of those myths are starting to be busted now that we have the science to explain it.
So does business accept that that's the case, do you think?
When we explain it to people, there's almost a relief, isn't there? People are almost going, oh, I always felt that to be true. And a lot of our messages are a little bit contrary to what we've been told before, but once they hear it, they believe it. Once they start doing little exercises, like simply for a day, doing one task at a time, they can see the results straight away. So it really is something in business that we encourage people, you've got to go and practice. It's not the theory that's going to make the difference, it's that practice, and they see the results straight away.
So is it about slowing down, or is it just about focusing on the task at hand?
That's the challenge, because really, I don't think our world will slow down. Things will keep coming at us. So it's not actually about trying to change that world. It's actually recognising what you're doing with your attention when you're exposed to multiple challenges at once. And as Susan says, if you try to multitask, traditionally that is, I want to put every ball up in the air at the same time and I'm just going to keep juggling them. And hopefully I'll keep them all up and I might get some of them done, but I'm never quite sure which one I've got done because I've forgotten what I was doing on that one by the time I get back to that one. And a lot of them get dropped. And the way attention really works is that it switches between things. And this is where the science is so valuable. When we understand attention, we can see that it actually always did switch between things. But if you don't switch with clarity and with control, that's when you start to lose the focus in multitasking. So multitasking is a myth, but switching between things with that clarity is something you can do when you've got 10 things coming at you, because that's the reality of the world. And we're certainly not saying to people, you're going to be able to turn the world down.
Yeah.
But your attention can be used so much more clearly and cleanly between things.
So when did it dawn on you that this was the case, that we were living in this society where fewer and fewer people paid attention, that it was a broad sort of cultural phenomenon that perhaps you'd been, I don't know, perhaps you'd been swept up in it yourself?
Absolutely.
Susan, when did you realise this was a thing?
I certainly have ended up working in the field that I needed the most at the time. So I think I would have been awarded for having the busiest mind on the planet if you looked back 20 years ago. And I suffered the consequence of what I call a bit of a quarter-life crisis, where I just woke up one day and said, despite all this busyness, despite all this ticking off things on the checklist, I didn't have that deep sense of fulfillment, and went on a bit of a search for meaning and happiness, as you do. It took us to some interesting places where we met the Dalai Lama and got to touch Richard Gere. That was
Richard Gere.
Sorry, but that was the highlight for me. But I think when we first started looking at some of those sciences, and we explored all different areas of science, but one particular conference comes to mind where the Dalai Lama and Buddhists were dialoguing with Western psychiatrists, psychologists, and, you know, some of the people who were the smartest in the world around the nature of the mind. And this dialogue was interesting because watching them on stage, the Western scientists were doing what we would probably tend to do in the past, which is, you know, cramming in the last thoughts before they have the dialogue, having these debates. The Buddhists were sitting there meditating. And I remember at the time going, oh, I feel a bit embarrassed for them because they're not going to keep up. You know, they're just sitting there doing nothing, would you believe? And it wasn't the case. And it was really a moment for me where I thought, success, wisdom, knowledge, insight does not come from a busy mind. It comes from a clear mind. The things that came out of their mouths, like, it was just so evident to me it was about a clear mind. And that's what we went on for, I suppose, the last 15 years to teach in business, the practical art of being present. So I think, again, we hear that word all the time, be present, I've got to be present. No one quite knows how to do it, and that was really what we set about to do, to wake up the world by teaching them that practical skill. And it had amazing results straight away, but what we've seen in the last 5 years is it's a skill that's dying.
And did you have an epiphany moment as well?
I think I was always attracted to sciences or philosophies that lent this way without necessarily being able to put my finger on why.
So Eastern type philosophies and Eastern religions?
Even though my background is very, very mainstream because I did engineering, which almost sort of take you completely away from a lot of that. But I've always had an attraction to Eastern philosophies, practices like that, and the blend. And I think the fascination to me of the science of it, because being an engineer and being a practical person,
yeah,
I really liked to find that. We just live in a perfect time now to understand how some of those things
well,
work.
Well, we ran a talk on Big Ideas earlier in the year that was recorded at Woodford on mindfulness meditation, and it strikes me that mindfulness very much influences the work that you're doing. The difference was, it was talking about how mindfulness worked from a scientific perspective. Mm. We had an enormous response, actually, to that talk when we played it. Mm. And it seems like that way of thinking is going through a moment right now. Perhaps this is the response to the crazy lives that we've all found ourselves living, do you think?
I think so. And I think, too, that our motivating, our driving force has always been about mainstreaming mindfulness, but also helping people to understand that you don't have to do your 20 minutes meditation and, you know, sit in a cave and all of those types of things, but you can bring it into every part of your life. And we often say that, you know, 1 hour of mindfulness is not going to make up for 16 hours of mindlessness. It's about bringing those moments into ordinary parts of your day.
So you sound like you are verging on sort of new agey in your thinking, but actually you run a successful business and you don't see yourself as new age types at all, really, do you?
I don't think many people would say we're very new agey, and it's probably a result of having come to this fairly early, not having necessarily come to it, you know, because of a new age sort of bent, but because of inquisitive curiosity about the mind, the brain, and our background being in business. How can people in business not just be successful, but be significant in some way? How can business be meaningful and purposeful? Because that's when people do their best work, so they bring their best to work. And it took us, you know, as Susan said, we researched and investigated a lot of fields before we combined them all to say there are just a few common truths around this, that humans, like all other living systems, have to adapt to the world around them, and to be the most successful, we have to see what's happening in front of us in real time. We have to be able to respond to it with clarity without getting everything that is sort of in our minds in the way. And that was really our driving motivation, was to help people in business and leaders in particular to be responsive to the world as it changes. And you have to have a clear mind.
Because you were sensing that actually this was getting in the way of business and of productivity, were you?
Absolutely. Because I think when you look at it, as you were saying before, that mindfulness was a response to the overwhelm and the distraction in individual lives, the same thing was going on in corporate life. So corporations were facing unprecedented rates of change, unpredictability, you know, starting to be in that space where they go, we actually can't control a lot of what's going on in our future. So it all came back to their state of mind again.
So that's interesting. I would have thought that a lot of employers would have thought of employees that couldn't do two or three things at once, that they were either lazy or incompetent. You've explained how multitasking, in fact, is not efficient at all. Do many businesses appreciate, understand that?
I think so much more now. When we started, we're talking 15 years ago, I think what businesses appreciated is that the world was changing rapidly, and to be effective, you needed to have clarity and being able to respond to things very effectively. But in the last 5 years, we have noticed a real shift. And that shift has been people talking about being busy and being busy-minded.
Yeah.
But then in the last couple of years, people talking about feeling like their life has no meaning. They feel disconnected and they feel overwhelmed. And life's like in black and white. Mm. And to us, there's a continuum of this journey that we're all experiencing, where we're being pulled further and further away from the world because we're trying to keep everything in our heads and trying to respond to everything all the time. And all it does is put our attention inside and disconnect us from what's really going on around us.
I think, too, one of the other interesting statistics out of research that has switched companies and employers on is that people at work are spending over 60% of their time lost in thought. So doing a task with their mind on something totally different. So this was a study from Harvard University where it actually gave a more general statistic to say that 47% of the time we are all lost in thought. So for nearly half our lives, we're on autopilot, doing one thing, thinking about something else. So when you think about that from an individual's point of view, it's alarming. But when you think of it from a corporation's point of view, imagine if you could switch just 10% of that on. Like what that would actually do to productivity, performance, all of those things.
You're with Big Ideas on RN, online and on your mobile with me, Paul Barclay. Tonight, I'm talking to Martina Sheehan and Susan Pierce at the Powerhouse in Brisbane about training our minds to be present so we can pay attention to the things that matter. And I always pay attention. Well, I try my best, as you're about to hear.
You see, I do these interviews for a living, like I'm doing with you now, conversations, and I have to listen to what people are saying, obviously, and so I'm paying attention to what's happening around me. But every now and then, very rarely, I'll just drift off for a moment. And I'll have this question that I'm about to ask, and it'll be this deep fear in me. Have they already asked this question that I'm about to ask? Have they answered the question I'm about to ask? It's terrible. Rarely happens. It won't happen today, I promise. This idea of full attention, giving something your full attention, can you describe what that involves, like what that means?
Well, I think the first real trick to this is it's actually a gentle action. It's not a hard forced action. So people will often mix up what we're saying about giving full attention to something as being concentrated and focused. And you get that feeling that people are frowning and they're gazing in really centeredly at something. And of course, that's so narrowed. That's really attention captured. It's really probably as ineffective as attention wandering because we're missing a lot of other things around it. So when we talk about bringing full attention, I think it's a feeling every human being knows, is to simply stop all of this activity of mine and probably a lot of physical activity at the time to do this and simply open your eyes, open your ears, and just sort of face the world and let it in. And that openness is when we see things, hear things, feel things, and our attention becomes much more effective. So it is very...
You're being physically still when this is happening too, are you?
Well, I mean, physically still maybe in the beginning when you're first trying to get yourself out of some of these bad habits. Yeah. But certainly attention doesn't need to be physically still. Yeah. It's very much a sort of an intention that we have, that I want to be here with this. And you can be moving, but you just want to be present with something.
Because you can, as you say, be exercising and giving full attention, be listening and giving full attention. Because I think we get the mind and the body mixed up a little bit like that, that we often say, oh, I do have a break during the day. I go and get my cup of tea, but when I'm getting my cup of tea, I'm thinking about my to-do list and, you know, what I'm going to have for dinner, all of those types of things. So we're talking about body can be moving, but the mind is actually paying full attention. And it's interesting because the dictionary definition of attention is to tend to care for. So it's like, you know, a mother tending to her child or a son caring for an elderly parent. It's not a concentrated focus.
Yeah, so by giving attention, you're caring for someone, and therefore by not giving attention or by not giving full attention, you're denying them in some way that care. So it's a denial of the fullness of a relationship, really, is what you're suggesting.
It's almost a physical thing. And I think we actually say it is a physical thing. You know when someone's paying attention clearly and openly, and you know when they're not.
And it's quite insulting too, isn't it?
It is. Well,
when it's obvious that they're not paying attention.
Absolutely. We say that when you are checking your mobile phone or your eyes are wandering all over the place when you have someone in front of you, you may as well be holding up a sign that says, I don't care. And I first discovered this with my daughter, actually, where she was saying, Mummy, you know, listen to me. Mummy, you're not listening. You don't care about me. And I think, you know, some of these things that we're hearing from these pure minds are just so true. And it also applies in the workplace that a leader who is too busy running through all of this doing gives off the message to their employee that they don't care. And that's what drives performance, engagement, all of those things.
That mobile phone thing, though, you do see young couples out for dinner. Seems to be some of these, like, first, second date, really early relationships, and they're both on the phone. They seem pretty relaxed about it, though, don't they?
They're changing their Facebook status to, I'm in a relationship. I don't know, but that's what you're saying. What sort of connecting's going on there?
It's a different era, isn't it? And, you know, I suppose we all adapt to the era we grow up in, but there would be a question there as to how strong the relationship is between the people who are not looking at each other or not responding to each other, and they're connecting somewhere else. So, you know, the age of connection is also the age of disconnection.
So is this about slowing down and doing less? You know, if we follow your philosophy of connecting, paying attention, being present, does it inevitably mean that we will do less, get less done?
It means you'll get done what matters most. That's the question we need to ask ourselves. I don't believe that any human being, and particularly in the business environments that we all operate in, can do every single thing they think they should have to do in a day. Our attention is a limited resource. It is literally limited. We should consider when we wake up in the morning, we only have a certain amount to give, like a bucket. When you've doled it out, it runs out. And if you run out early in the day, you feel exhausted. And how many people come home at night, they open the door and they go, I just hope someone doesn't want me to have a conversation with them. Mm. I just haven't got the energy to play with the kids. I don't want you to ask how my day was. I want to sit in front of the TV and do nothing. And of course, that mental exhaustion is because you've used up all the resource that you usually would connect with the things that matter most. And the unfortunate thing for most business people in that scenario is that the things that matter most are at home, if we ask ourselves that deep question. That's where that really matters, and that's what's getting the least often.
Because it's happening at the end of the day when people are exhausted and they've got nothing left to spend.
And their head's full of the things I haven't finished, rerunning the meeting that didn't go well, worrying about the report that I have to finish tomorrow, better get back to my emails after dinner. So when we say we would do less, we might do less, but it would be because we realise what matters most, and that a lot of the things that we force ourselves to give attention to and waste attention on are just things that come at us and intrude. If we stopped for a moment and paused, we would say, really? Does that matter? Do I even need to finish that? But we're not stopping long enough to ask that really challenging question that would say this doesn't matter and that does.
But sometimes we know rationally that what you've just said is the case, right? But practically we lack the tools to implement it. So those three examples you've given, you've had a bad day at work, the meeting's gone badly, you've got a report to write that hasn't been finished, and you've got a stack of emails that you haven't opened, let alone answered. And so you come home thinking, oh my God, it's just... And you know rationally that worrying about it and stressing it about it is not getting any of that done. But it's very hard for many people to just leave that baggage at work, come home, think I'm going to have a beautiful time with the kids and with my wife. So what tips can you give us about how you go about literally doing that, unshackling you from that?
I think understanding first that it actually becomes an addiction. And at the basic level of all of this is the principle that we are all training our brains every single moment of the day. So when I'm at work, racing from one meeting to the next, thinking about other things, flicking on phones, emails, all of that sort of stuff, when I come home, my brain just repeats that pattern. Because at no time does your brain go, oh, no, stop, Susan, you're home, you don't need to do that yet. It just says, this is what she wants me to do, so I'm going to fire up and do that very well. So we teach a whole range of different strategies for it. One is having a little bit of a clear line between when work finishes and home starts, and just a simple practice of pausing as you're getting out of the car. Because always coming back to your senses is what brings you to the present moment as well. So having a pause where you could even take a deep breath, you could just feel your hand on the car door there and almost mentally go, okay, well, that's staying till tomorrow. And I think it is about getting in the driver's seat where your mind is concerned, because if you're not there, you're getting taken for a ride. So you really need to be in that driver's seat of directing your attention, because that's how you'll retrain it, to basically say, okay, fully present with my family now. When I walk in, the first thing I'm going to do is sit down with my husband and wife and have a conversation and really listen.
And the real trick to all of these is they're just small moments. For any of us who have been sort of in a whirlwind for a long time, to expect anyone in that situation to suddenly go, I'm going to be present with everyone and everything, it is not going to happen.
Yep.
And one of the things we always warn people, even when you start, even if you only start with the smallest thing, your brain will scream out at you that this feels wrong.
Yep.
This is uncomfortable. Go back to your old habits. Because the brain, like the body, it's so trainable. So only start with one moment. That's why we talk about one moment.
Mm.
We can all do one moment in some part of our day that we know we should have been more present.
Mm.
And if we just start there and say, today all I'm going to do is give one more moment of attention to people in the meeting before I start thinking about what I'm going to do in the next meeting.
Yeah.
Just one moment longer. Yeah. And it's like a drip on your brain. Eventually, over time, it's just drip, 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 saying, that's the new practice I'm supposed to be doing because that's what you want me to do. And the moments start appearing elsewhere.
Mm.
I mean, the reality is life is a series of moments.
Yeah. So it's a bit like cognitive behavioural change. So, for example, I mean, one way in which stress can build is if you have a mobile phone, a smartphone, as I do, with email attached to it. Even worse still, if you have a little buzzer mechanism that buzzes in your pocket every time the email comes, and in my case, if the buzzer mechanism was switched on, it would never stop buzzing.
Mm.
But that sense that in your pocket right now is this work that's just continually flowing while you're building a Lego house with the kids, for example. So one way would just be to get the phone, take it out of your pocket, right, and just hide the bloody thing.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people do that, have the device-free night or have the I'll hide my phone. It's a good solution. An even better solution is to get your impulse control back.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what sits at the root of this, that just because something's alerting doesn't mean we need to follow it. We're always going to get distracted by it because our attention goes to our dominant senses, so sight and sound. Mobile phones play on both of those things, but it doesn't mean you need to actually follow it. You can see it and make a choice to get back to the Lego house.
Yeah.
And it's those small moments. You may only do it, as Martina said, once that day, and there may be other days you follow your phone, but the building of those small moments is what makes the difference.
Mm. We get that sense when we're on holidays, don't we? When we can leave it behind. First week takes a while for us to shake the habits. By the second week, and if you have a long holiday, by that third or fourth week, you really are able to, like, go to the beach and just sit there on the beach and taking in how beautiful the surf is or how beautiful the, you know, the sky is and so on.
Mm.
And holidays are a way in which, I suppose, where we're practicing removing ourselves from all of those distractions.
Yeah.
The trick is to bring that into our life when we're not on holidays.
Because otherwise we're always waiting till the holiday, waiting till the, you know, retreat I go on. And those times to really drive your attention crazy for 3 months and rely on the holiday is only going to do justice for some and have impact for some small amount of time.
Yeah.
So people say they come back from a holiday and a week later they feel like they never went.
Mm.
Everyone has a great resolve during the holiday. I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to do that. And this is the thing, only you can get your attention back under control. And it's not the hard, big things. And we always say to people, don't start with the biggest challenge you have. Actually, start with the small things during the day, because this whole thing about being on autopilot for half our day, it's usually those small, mundane things we do every day that we go onto autopilot with. So, you know, so many people would not even have any recollection of driving home and, you know, turning up in their garage and they go, I'm not quite sure what happened on that trip. I don't know how I got here. But, you know, I'm on autopilot, the body knows the moves, so the brain switches off. But the brain never switches off. It just goes and wanders to something else. So attention's always flowing somewhere, but is it flowing where you want it to flow?
On RN and on your mobile, you're listening to Big Ideas with me, Paul Barclay. Tonight, I'm in conversation with Martina Sheehan and Susan Pierce at The Powerhouse about their new book, One Moment, Please. It's Time to Pay Attention.
Action.
Hello, I'm Virginia Trioli.
And I'm Michael Rowland. Every morning on your telly, ABC News Breakfast serves up the stories and starts the conversations that matter.
What we have today is a 21st century government.
From whatever's being talked about.
The Australian dollar.
To what's about to be talked about.
Do you have a scoop?
It's a very rare thing in the history of the game.
We have all the facts you need.
Another hailstorm.
And a little bit of fun.
ABC News Breakfast.
Weekday mornings from 6 on ABC TV.
Let's head back to the powerhouse to discuss time and my lack of it. I think the other thing is there's a sense of urgency about our life. The older you get, the more you realise, right, that life is this finite thing, that time starts to be immeasurably more valuable to you, and a whole lot of the things you're prepared to do in, say, your 20s, you're not prepared to do in your 50s because you realise it's just a bloody waste of time. There's also that sense of urgency. I have not got a moment to waste is a feeling I have all of the time. There's all of these books I want to read that I haven't had a chance to read yet. There's all these places I want to see. So there is a sense of urgency even in that, right? Is that a problem?
I think that sense of urgency probably drives you in a different direction, because the thing that you're really looking for is not time, it's attention. And you know how you can spend time, like spend time with the kids, and there may not be very much attention going on whatsoever. Your head's caught up in worries or whatever else. But you can just have small moments of attention, and when you are giving those moments, that's when you create that connection. So it's like you could push yourself to read all these books, but as you're reading them, you know, you get to the bottom of the page and it's like, what went on in that page there? So the doing anything without attention disconnects you from whatever you're doing. So I think, yeah, it makes a case for more attention.
You do say, though, that idle time should not be considered as wasted time. It is very tempting, isn't it, in the modern busy world to think that if you're not doing something, if you're being idle, that you're just wasting time. How do we get people to reevaluate out that sense of time?
Idle is such an interesting word, because it's been diagnosed as lazy and slothful, but it actually means to rest. And attention, you know, it needs to rest. It's like an animating force. You know, we talk about it. It needs rest periods, and then it needs to work hard, and then it needs to rest. And our stress and all that follow that pattern. So if we never rest it, we're always on and we're stressed. People say, I have no time for that. But if you think about your day, there are moments of, we call downtime, idle time, scattered through the day. So you look at people who are waiting in queue for a takeaway coffee. Instead of just putting their head up and laying their attention, maybe look at the world, people watch, see what the day is like, hear the birds and smell the coffee and wait for their coffee. They've got their head down and they're checking messages. And often I don't think they're checking them because that was the time they really needed to check them. They just don't feel like they can not fill their attention
to something.
It's so true,
isn't it? You know, I get a lot of planes for my job, and the place that sells coffee at Brisbane Airport has a sign on the front of the coffee shop that if you're on the phone or looking at your mobile phone when you're ordering coffee, they will not take your order. And I think that's really cool, actually, because, you know, the bloody airport's full of all these busy businessmen with their phones looking down and looking up, and they're like, no, if you can't even, you know, be polite enough and engaged enough to ask me for a coffee and tell me what coffee you want.
Yeah, that's the thing. Whenever you see people waiting, whether it's waiting for a bus, waiting in line at the bank. I've actually got a friend who met her husband waiting in the queue to an ATM. Imagine if she was on the phone, she would have missed that opportunity. So, you know, as well as the rest, as well as attention needing to rest, and it sure does, you're also missing things when you've got your head down all the time.
Yeah, it's so true, isn't it? Do you think we're actually afraid of being bored? Is that part of the reason that we squeeze so much into our lives, do so many things at the one time, that there's a fear of stillness in a way? When things are still, we start to think about things, our mind wanders, we start to think about things that are perhaps troubling, unnerving about ourselves, and that can be scary. And so instead, we just fill our mind up with all this other junk. It's just a theory. Psychobabble maybe on my part.
Probably, you've probably got the theory right. There was a really interesting study that was done on people asked to sit in stillness for 15 minutes, no distractions, and how they felt about that. Basically, that was so uncomfortable for the majority of people. They were given one option. They could give themselves an electric shock. And very high proportions of people preferred to give themselves a mild electric shock than sit in stillness.
I heard about this experiment. That is scary,
that's
isn't it?
That's pretty telling.
Running away from your own mind, isn't it?
Yeah.
And is that a sign of our times? I mean, unless the experiments were done over the generations, it's hard to prove scientifically, but I think it would be a question we need to ask ourselves. Would I really choose to do that? What am I so afraid of that would be going on in my mind? And in fact, we all know the greatest progress of our own lives individually is when we stop and we reflect on something, or we finally face something that's been going on in our gut for a long time.
Mm.
And we take a moment, we stand back and we go, I need to do that.
Mm.
I need to leave this job, or I need to change what I'm doing. There's something I'm more passionate about. What am I so scared of? Unless we ask ourselves those questions, we do stay on a treadmill, like you say, and that's not where the great rewards come from.
Mm.
Unfortunately, sometimes it's not a pretty picture in there, because it's been suggested we have up to 70,000 thoughts a day, and 70% of those are negative. So I think, as you're saying, for someone to actually stop and hear those, because of course, when we're busy, we don't hear them.
Mm.
You know, if you really asked people how many thoughts could you count in a day, you wouldn't be anywhere near 70,000. So we fill up all of this activity, so we're not really hearing what's going on in there. Because even this issue of achieving stillness, 100% stillness isn't humanly possible, because our minds wander, get every 6 to 10 seconds. So what we're not talking about here is aspiring to be
empty.
Yeah.
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 You're always going to have.
You're always switched on and active to some extent.
Yep. It's always moving.
And it's about, again, that driver's seat, because you can be distracted by a thought and go, oh, there's a thought I'm going to come back to listening to Paul. Or you can be distracted by a thought and end up in Europe backpacking in the 80s.
Yeah.
And that's what the problem is, the fact that we are actually losing all awareness of where our mind's going.
Okay. Facebook. So what fascinates me about Facebook is that it appears to be about connecting with people, about friends, your Facebook friends. Never has a word been so debauched as the word friend has in the Facebook context. Friend can mean someone you have no idea about, you never met, and so on. How much of a distraction is Facebook and the like, in your humble opinion?
Jeez, an interesting one, isn't it? Because on one hand, you see all these amazing sort of things happen sometimes that couldn't have happened if Facebook didn't exist. For example, someone saying, you know, I found something and I'm going to put a message out in the world and see if someone knows who this belonged to.
Mm.
And, you know, days later, connections are made and suddenly the person is found. And you go, well, there you go, that's amazing. And that's why we always say, we would never say get rid of technology and things like that, because when it's used for purpose like that, it's powerful. But it's when we cannot stop checking it to see if we've missed something.
Yeah.
When all we're missing is someone's inane comment about something that came across their mind during that day, when we should be doing something else.
Mm.
So there are certainly times where we want to graze through it and we want to see what our friends have been doing. Maybe there's a photo of their children. I haven't seen them for a long time. But if I then start clicking through and I go to a link to an article and I go, that's really interesting, and half an hour later, you're just going, I only had a 5-minute cup of tea and I'm gone.
And even if you're just taking a quick look, because I know there's a little bit of a trend of when people are feeling like they need a rest from that report at work or whatever else it might be, I'll just check Facebook, and they're saying, you know, get a good rest out of that. But the interesting thing is that when we have an interruption like that, it takes our brain 25 minutes to return to that original level of focus. So when you think about that, if you are checking Facebook and then I'll do a little bit more and then I'll, you know, there's a beep of the text coming through or the email, that's explaining a lot of the loss of productivity, whether that's at work or even at home where you're going, I'm not getting through anything that I'm doing.
So do you make recommendations to employers about social media use in the workplace because of that?
Well, actually, it's an interesting one. We've never been asked about it. And I think it's because even if we were, we would say, you have to make that call.
Yeah.
What we would encourage you to do
is
give people the skills to make wise choices about where they're using their attention.
Mm.
Because until every one of us has those skills back, the skills that we actually should have as human beings, impulse control, choice, wise choices, to use our attention for what it's been given to us for, which is to connect with the world, until we're all doing that, you can play around the edges with a lot of these things, and as we would say, you can get people to not check any social media at work and their mind will be thinking about what they're missing.
Mm. There are not enough hours in the day. How often do you hear that said in the modern world? People just feeling like when they go to bed at night that they wish they had a few more hours to get all that stuff done. But you think this is an essentially disempowering way of viewing the world, don't you?
It is, because we put ourselves under some sort of pressure to create something that is not creatable. We cannot get more time. What we choose to do with the time where we give our attention is where the returns come. If we could actually change the language and people would stop talking about I need more time or I'm under time pressure, I need to time manage, and start putting the word attention in there, then you can do something. Because that's where I can actually get much more back in my day, because there's a lot of time I'm not paying attention. So every moment I claw back is a gift back and something I get back. And I can't do that with time.
We're sort of setting ourselves up to fail, really, by saying something like that, aren't we?
Yeah. And, I mean, there is certainly a whole range of little practices and things that you can do to feel like you're getting more done. And one of them, which I think is an interesting one, is what your first thoughts are when you wake up at the start of the day. Are they, what day is it, what do I have to do today, what's my to-do list, grab my phone, start running through Facebook and emails, and it's like before your feet have even hit the floor, your attention is actually bogged down. And that first up to an hour of when we wake up really lays the pathways for how our attention unfolds that day. And if you can make that first 45 minutes be about being present, your day is going to flow in a totally different direction and you will achieve more.
When I hear that phrase, are you paying attention, I'm instantly taken back to being a school student. And it makes me wonder how good our schools are at teaching our kids to be attentive in the sense that you're talking about being in the moment. Do you think that we are teaching kids to be present? I mean, I know there's this focus on concentrate on your studies, but more generally about being present?
Teachers definitely know that there's a pretty major issue. We chatted to a range of teachers, particularly those who have been teaching for 20 years, and the difference they've seen in children's attention in the classroom is quite dramatic. You know, they said kids have always wandered off, but these days it's hard to get their attention back onto things. And, you know, it suggested that kids, this was a US type of study, kids' attention spans are down to 4 seconds. So when you think about that, that's pretty alarming. Schools are doing things like, you know, they might have dance breaks between lessons and, you know, are doing little resilience programs and things like that. But I think it's that the next step we need to take is to really, yeah, almost have a curriculum on this is how you work with your attention. It is the most powerful thing we've got. We do PE classes, but, you know, imagine if we were all given these instructions when we were young about what nourishes attention, what, you know, can damage it, we'd be living.
I love the idea of living a life where you're fully present. But the reality is not every conversation is riveting, not everything we see around us is beautiful. Our mind drifts sometimes because we're just bloody bored or we look out the window at some ugly part of the landscape. Can we really be present all of the time?
Well, we're certainly not suggesting anyone will as a result of what we're talking about. And, you know, it's back to what if we could just be 10% more present or even one moment one day more present and we experience something that we normally miss.
You're with Big Ideas on RN with me, Paul Barclay. Tonight I'm talking with the authors of a new book called One Moment, Please. It's Time to Pay Attention, Martina Sheehan and Susan Pierce. Time now for some questions from the floor at the Powerhouse. And the first one was one I heartily approve of.
One of the things that I like to do, because the drive that I have is generally half an hour minimum up to an hour, is to listen to podcasts while I'm driving.
Ah, good idea.
Is that... you're not allowed to answer this, Paul. Is that considered multitasking or is that a good use of time? Because it's I could listen to the radio, or I actually like silence because I have two small children, but podcasts are, it's a way for me to use that time. But if it's multitasking, then I need to move away from it.
It's a similar one to that question about should I let my children study with the music on, you know, that type of thing. And what it comes down to really is that if you were driving with no podcast on and your mind was more likely to roam all over the place and be a lot busier, then the podcast actually serves some sort of purpose because it brings your attention down to two sources as opposed to 10 different sources. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's a good thing.
And in those cases, we're switching for a moment. Yep. Our eyes are on the road for a moment. We're listening. We're missing a little bit of both. But again, we are in normal life with a lot of these things anyway. So it's just that conscious choice.
Given that a lot of situations require attention from more than one party, so even if we achieve some sort of Zen-like ability to be present with situations with people in meetings and especially with kids, are there any tips or is there advice on how do we encourage short sending them to one of your sessions and getting people to be more present when you're engaging with them?
Yeah. We often get this one, and I hope you're not asking it from this point of view, which is, this is great stuff, how can I get my wife to do this? Or how can I get my kids to do this or my husband? And the answer always from us is the start with you, that your ability to influence someone else's attention is just amazing. Like, we all have this set of neurons in our brain called mirror neurons, which essentially make us mirror each other, feel each other's feelings, thoughts and that type of thing. It's amazing as a parent when your attention becomes more full and present, the shift you see in them. So always kind of back to start with yourself, because it often starts some really good conversations as well with
and
the kids.
And it's interesting that, you know, give attention should always be the first thing, not get attention. I mean, you will get it back. We know when we start to give attention, it actually is like a magnetising sort of force. It actually fills the room. When people just stop what they're doing, put it down and they turn and they look at you, something starts to fill between you and it draws other people's attention to the present. So it's a good experiment for everyone.
Hello, I'm really enjoying the talk tonight, thank you. Just interested in what you said before about the transition when we're going sort of from work into home life, and just wanted to ask if you had any thoughts about the increasing trend for people working from home.
Yes, which we both do. And I think neither of us are very sort of structured around what we do there, and I think that's probably quite normal. But again, it's about whether you can shift your attention to other aspects when you're doing something. So I work at my computer, but someone else is in the house often. And if they come home, there's a presence there of another person. So what I am conscious of is actually finishing whatever I'm writing or reading to a certain point, know where I finished, and then turning my body and giving my attention to say hello. And then to have an interaction, and there's a moment to then turn back and keep going. So those sort of things obviously happen a lot. But, I mean, there is obviously a reality too that there's a point in the day where we have to be careful the addiction isn't what's keeping us working, as distinct from the real need of the work. And it's back to that addiction issue. Is it technology? Am I missing something? Oh, gee, my to-do list is going around in my head, so I better go back to the computer and finish something. So it's, again, is my attention now in the place it belongs, which is engaging with the family, having dinner, tasting my food, you know, those sort of things.
Hi. I wanted to ask about the beautiful email. I mean, you talked before about social media and the disruption of that at work. You know, it's easy to turn that off, but email is a lot harder to turn off, particularly the work emails. And, you know, that fabulous thing that's been implemented, you might be writing a report and the emails flash up and you can see there's an email from this person, email from that person, and they don't stop. My email's a bit like Paul's. It's, you know, it's constantly going. Any advice on how do you work with the email thing? You know, do you advise to shut it down and only check it at certain points? You know, the curiosity's running even if you're not checking it. So just interested in any advice on email.
The alerts coming up, whether it's sound or popping up, is playing to those dominant senses. And none of us can miss something that pops like that. The eyes will be drawn. So, and once the eyes are drawn, the mind starts wandering. And again, the only real tool we have that can beat something like that is the impulse control. But of course, we can put things in place to help us build that. So turning the alerts off is a great one. Then noticing the habit we have of wondering and how quickly that returns. And it's there that you have your opportunity to work. Okay, and go, oh, now I'm wondering if I'm missing something. Okay, maybe if I could just for one moment longer stay with what I'm doing with full attention and check it in 2 minutes. And I'm training my brain, keep coming back to what I'm working on. Yes, it's wandered. Okay, you've wandered. But I want to help you get a really good habit of staying with what I want you to stay with. And working again gently, not fighting it, just noticing it, bringing it back, noticing and bringing it back. And this is the exercising of attention that becomes stronger over time. We're all going to get those things. Don't worry, we still get that challenge. But you see it happen, you make a conscious choice to either go and check them or come back.
I often think about it, you know, toddlers, if you're taking them to the park and there's a bit of a pathway there and they tend to just go off all over the place. Our attention's a little bit like that, and so it's just the gentle guiding it back to the path that it should be on, gently guiding it back. And I think challenging too, sometimes we inflate the importance of needing to be contacted straight away. I mean, if you go back to the olden days, a couple of decades ago, no one could contact you. You know, it's just that it's an always on world now, but how important is it to respond to things straight away?
Mm. And they're all different. So we end up doing them all the same, but they're all different.
Yeah. Mm. An old boss of mine actually gave me a hit. This is not really specifically in terms of being present, but if you're the sort of person that gets emails that agitate you or that are likely to cause you stress, and you know, I've been in sort of management type jobs in the ABC where that was the case, she said not to open your email for the first hour or two at work so that you don't get into that habit where the first thing you see in at work every day is something that just causes you stress. So get to work, do something that needs to be done that you can be engaged and enjoy, and then open your email up a little bit later. And I've followed that advice mostly, and it's a pretty good idea actually, because there is nothing worse than coming in and just, you know, copying it between the eyes every morning.
Yeah.
Do what matters most first.
I was actually wondering whether there was anybody in the audience who previously led a frenetic, disconnected, you know, type of life, who's put into place some of those strategies and who feels a lot freer and a lot more present. And if there was anybody who would like to just tell us about what, how it's worked for them. Yeah? Anyone? Yeah, we've got someone.
Hi. I haven't done a great deal and I've got a long way to go, but I had a lock installed on my home office door. So when I finish work now, I physically lock the door and I go and start my home business, whatever I need to do that evening, whether it's cooking dinner or whatever. Quite often I need to revisit the office, but not in that official business capacity. It's because it's a room in my house. But the lock has really, really helped me turn off from work of an evening.
Fantastic. Simple.
Significant.
Simple but significant.
It'd be good if we could get that same lock for our
head,
yeah.
Turn off.
Yeah.
Would you please thank our two fantastic guests today, Martina and Susan? You've been listening to Martina Sheehan and Susan Pierce in conversation with me at the Powerhouse in Brisbane in August of last year. Their book, One Moment Please, It's Time to Pay Attention, was published by Hay House Australia. And that's it for Big Ideas for tonight. On Sunday at 9 in the morning, as part of our summer series, you can hear the inside story on Bitcoin and the reinvention of money. Bitcoin arrived on the scene in 2009 during the global financial crisis, and there were great hopes it might offer a viable alternative to a mainstream financial system that was clearly struggling. 6 years later, Bitcoin has yet to gain acceptance as currency. It's been at the centre of a number of scandals and linked closely to the illicit drug trading site, the Silk Road. But despite all this, the idea behind Bitcoin is being taken very seriously by governments, Silicon Valley, and the finance industry. Why the interest? Find out Sunday morning at 9 or anytime online at abc.net.au/rn. Until next time, I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for your company. Bye for now.